From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, preparing Christian homeschooled students to engage in the battle to take the land. That's how Michael Farris describes one of his goals. We'll talk with Farris about founding Patrick Henry College, the first college for Christian students who were homeschooled. In 2004, 7% of the White House interns came from this small college. Farris also founded Generation Joshua, a project to encourage younger homeschooled Christians to be politically active and help get out the vote. Also, critic at large John Powers reviews The Passenger, the 1975 film starring Jack Nicholson, directed by Antonioni. It's now out on DVD. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As a leader of the Christian homeschooling movement, my guest Michael Farris is preparing students to, as he puts it, engage wholeheartedly in the battle to take the land. Hard to do, he says, in the land of MTV, internet porn, abortion, homosexuality, and greed. Farris is the founder and president of Patrick Henry College, established in 2000 as the first college for homeschooled Christian students. Its self-described mission is to prepare Christian men and women who will lead our nation and shape our culture with timeless biblical values and fidelity to the spirit of the American founding. In 2004, 7% of the White House interns came from this small college. Farris also founded Generation Joshua, an organization for younger homeschooled Christian students who are encouraged to work on political campaigns and get out the vote. Our recent guest, Michelle Goldberg, devoted several pages to Farris in her book, Kingdom Coming, A Critical Look at Christian Nationalism. Michael Farris, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you found Patrick Henry College, the first college for homeschooled Christian students?
We believe that there was a need for a liberal arts college that was using a classical and Christian approach in the Washington, D.C. area for the purpose of training young people to be leaders on the national stage, both in politics, law, government, journalism, that sphere, as well as in the culture, in literature and history and classical liberal arts in education and so on. So we have a pretty wide scope for our vision. We want to be able to train some incredible young leaders.
We've been very successful in getting political placement for the students of Patrick Henry College. In the latest statistic I have is like spring 2004, Patrick Henry students had 7 of the 100 college internships at the White House. That's 7%. And how many graduates are there from Patrick Henry? I mean, it's a small school.
Well, as of right now, we have 160 graduates total over 5 years. So it is a small school. I mean, the statistical probability of being a White House intern is better at Patrick Henry College than any other college in the country. I mean, we place a high number of people, not just in the White House, but in various offices, Heritage Foundation, Senate offices, House offices, all kinds of places. We've had students at B'nai B'rith. It's been an exciting opportunity that young people have found through our college.
So what kind of context do you have in the White House that is behind this incredible placement record that you have?
One of our students worked at RNC, and my relationship—
The Republican National Committee.
Correct. And that one student did such a good job at RNC that he got a opportunity to go to the White House after that. And that one student, frankly, opened the door for the others because it's not based on personal relationships that I have, although I do have some relationships with some people in the White House, but that didn't hurt anything. But really what opened the door was the hard work that they've seen time after time from our students. And they're bright kids, they work hard, and they're not willing to, or they're not unwilling to get down and do what anybody says in terms of, you know, grunt work. They're willing to do what it takes to do the job well.
Is the president an advocate of Christian homeschooling?
The president has been a friend of homeschooling, Christian and non-Christian both, because when he was running in 2000, he asked homeschoolers what they wanted from the federal government, and the answer was basically, we want to be left alone. And he said, that's fine by me, and made promises to that, and he's kept those promises. So he's been a friend of homeschooling, yes, indeed.
What are some of the political issues that you most hope your students will work in support of?
Well, the position that I think is probably the highest priority for most of the young people is pro-life issues. There are a wide variety of interests beyond that, and really they get to make their own choices as to what they think is important. Some have worked on religious freedom issues, both internationally and in the United States, but some have worked on refugee issues, some have worked on pornography issues, some have worked on same-sex marriage issues, just, you know, a wide variety of issues, both domestic and foreign, economic and so on. Basically, go read the Washington Post for 6 months, and those are the issues the kids are interested in.
Well, you say you want them to make their own choices, but I think you want them to make their own choices within the biblical worldview. I mean, in order to be a student or to be a faculty member, you have to enthusiastically agree to a statement of faith and to endorse a statement of biblical worldview, which includes saying that although evolution and intelligent design will be taught, that creationism is the true story of creation. And
that's all true, but that doesn't tell you whether you're going to work on highway policy or going to work on some social issue or whether you're going to work on some economic issue. It really is, there's a philosophy that our college stands for. There's no doubt, and you've identified one component of that philosophy. But we do believe in freedom, and we operate in freedom, and the students choose what they want to work on. And so they're going to get some perspective. But, we frankly think that Patrick Henry College is an important component of bringing diversity to colleges as a whole, because colleges as a whole, universities as a whole, are so far left wing that somebody's got to be given the contrary viewpoint.
But when you say diversity, it sounds like there's perhaps not a lot of diversity within the college itself, because everybody in it has to endorse the statement of faith and the statement of biblical
that's
worldview.
True. Just as people at Harvard or Duke or so on who want to advance, who want to get tenure and so on, have to embrace the worldview of the left. The left dominates higher education in this country, and there's a professor at Northwestern that wrote an article on the internet called Blue State Islands and Red States, meaning that the colleges represent left values in conservative states, and he ridicules parents dropping off their kids with Jesus bumper stickers on their SUVs, wearing overalls. But he said, "Don't worry, lefties. Once they get into my classroom, we're going to change their views." That's what's going on, and anybody who doesn't recognize that, isn't accustomed to dealing with reality.
I know you feel strongly about a lot of colleges and universities. I mean, you've said the enemies of freedom and truth dominate our elite colleges and universities and thereby dominate our nation. So you see that the elite colleges and universities as enemies of freedom and truth.
Well, most of them don't even believe that such a thing as truth exists. It's kind of passé in our postmodern world to think that there is such a thing as truth. That's by their own self-declaration. I do think that the vast majority of colleges don't believe the principles of freedom because, as Thomas Jefferson said, we're endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. And unless you believe that rights come from a source above man, you can't really believe in inalienable rights. If men create rights, men can take away rights. Unless God creates rights, as Thomas Jefferson said, you can't get there intellectually.
Just as one challenge to your theory that all elite universities are liberal, Condoleezza Rice was a dean at Stanford University. Stanford University also is at the home base of the Hoover Institution, which is a libertarian think tank.
But Jack Rakove is at Stanford, who writes that in his book Original Meanings, says that he only uses original intent when it serves his purposes to accomplish the political objectives he wants. Otherwise, he doesn't like the theory of original intent. I think that Rakove is far more representative of where Stanford really is than Condoleezza Rice's tenure there.
My guest is Michael Farris, the founder of Patrick Henry College, the first college for Christian students who were homeschooled. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Farris. He's the founder and president of Patrick Henry College, which is the first college for Christian students who are homeschooled. He's also the founder of Generation Joshua, which is a campaign to turn homeschooled Christian students into political activists. In your book, The Joshua Generation, you write, the homeschooling movement will succeed when our children, the Joshua Generation, engage wholeheartedly in the battle to take the land. What does that mean, the battle to take the land?
Everyone who engages in politics, everyone who engages in public discussions, wants their philosophy to succeed. That's the nature of democracy. People who believe the kinds of things that I describe in that book and that we teach at Patrick Henry College, we want to be successful, just like everybody else. And in a democracy, people listen, and they decide which candidates, which ideas are the better ideas. And if they like the ideas of one, they vote for them. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about winning the war of ideas by having a better way of articulating our principles than the principles of people who are on the other philosophical camp.
Well, one of the main principles that the Patrick Henry School is based on is the statement of biblical worldview, and we'll get into the specifics of that in a moment. But I'm wondering if when you say take back the land, do you think America should be a Christian nation that America should subscribe to the biblical worldview that your school does?
Well, the term Christian nation is a very interesting term historically. If by Christian nation we're going to define it the way we do today, most people today, at least most Christians define it today, they have some vague idea of a generally Christian culture where morality is honored. That's not what the term meant at the founding of the country. A Christian nation at the founding of the country meant that every person in the nation was required by law to be a particular brand of Christian, as was practiced in England, as was practiced in Geneva, Spain, you name it, basically dominated Europe. America was never intended to be that kind of Christian nation. The way I would articulate the way the country was founded was as a free nation. It was founded by Christians, basically Christian dissenters who suffered under the hands of those who believed in that definition of Christian nation. They wanted to have a free nation where everyone of every faith was able to worship God the way they wanted, and they also wanted to be able to bring their values, whatever they were, into politics. And we want that kind of free nation that the Christian forefathers of this country embraced.
Now, all students, faculty, trustees, and employees must, quote, enthusiastically subscribe to a statement of faith.
And that's correct.
Let me just read a few things from the Statement of Faith. There is one God, Jesus Christ, is God in the flesh. The Bible, the Old and New Testaments, is the inspired word of God, inerrant and infallible. Jesus Christ literally will come to earth again in the second advent. All who die outside of Christ shall be confined in torment for eternity in hell. Why must everybody sign this statement of faith that includes other things as well before joining the school, either as a student, faculty, or trustee?
Because those are the principles that mark Orthodox Christianity in a broad sense. And we want to be training and have the young people who are there all embrace this philosophy. You know, we want to be a clear Christian college is the basic answer. And that's really not that different than what was practiced by most Christian schools, in the late 1700s, for example. And so we're following a time-honored process of saying, we're a Christian school, we want to have Christian professors, and we want to train Christian students. And we take some time to say particularly what we mean by Christianity, because there are people today who profess to be Christians who don't believe in the deity of Jesus, who doubt the authenticity of the Word of God, who think that all these things are kind of figurative. And, well, we're not that kind of Christian. We're the kind of Christian that takes the Bible very seriously.
And you also have a statement defining the college's biblical worldview, which students and faculty are expected to follow as well.
Not true.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's not true?
No. The students are not expected to follow that. The faculty are.
I see. And what is a biblical worldview? What does that mean?
If I were to say it again, I might not use the phrase biblical worldview, because worldview has fallen into a a kind of meaning that says you have your worldview, I have my worldview, and all worldviews are just a matter of perspective. Well, that's not what we mean by that. We're engaged in the search for truth, and we believe that the Bible is truth, and there is truth, and then there is error. And so, you know, most places don't even think that there is such a thing as truth and error anymore, but we do, and we're trying to reclaim both faith and reason, because reason has been rejected and jettisoned by a lot of thinkers these days, that, you know, it really is just a matter of perspective. It's just, you know, forces that have shaped your life, and there really isn't such a thing as truth or even facts, or it's gotten quite bizarre in the postmodern world of how far things have gone.
If you're interested in truth and reason, why do all of the biology teachers have to teach that, although they can teach Darwinian evolution, intelligent design, and other major theories, in the end, quote, they have to teach creation as both biblically true and as the best fit to observed data. If you believe in truth and reason,
true.
Why not keep a more open mind in your school to what most scientists, just about all scientists, believe, which is the evolutionary theory?
Well, you're overstating it to say that just about all scientists believe that. The dominant majority, there's no doubt that you're correct, because they reject as a matter of faith any presupposition that would allow them to believe in any alternative, despite the facts. I mean, if you want to see who's really open, let's go to the public school context. In the public school context, people do not want there's been legislation introduced, for example, once in Washington State that said, teach the facts that are for and against evolution. You know, not any other theory, just for and against evolution. And the evolutionists don't want that. They are not open enough to allow anyone to critique their favorite theory. And so, but we're not a public school. There's not a dime of government money that has ever entered at Patrick Henry College. And so we think, as an institution, we have applied our faith and our reason, and we've looked at the evidence, and we think that that's the answer. But we want our students, we don't require our students to believe that, and they are very, very insistent that they're going to look through this stuff. I mean, we've trained some absolutely fabulous debaters, for example, and they demand the evidence. And at the end of the day, they get to decide. But we just are very clear up front that what we're going to teach, just as every college in America is very up front that they're going to teach evolution as the truth. Well, we're very up front and say we're going to teach creation as the truth. There's really no difference.
In the statement of biblical worldview, it says marriage is a sacred God-made union between a man and a woman. Husbands are the head of their wives, just as Christ is the head of the church. What does that mean about husbands being the head of their wives?
It means they're the leader of the family, and that they have a responsibility for protection and love and care and concern. And I would point you to the work of William Tyndale in the 1500s in the book that he wrote, responding to Thomas More. He wrote a very remarkable, warm, balanced view of a Christian husband, and The Obedience of the Christian Man is his book, and you know, that's the classical view of Christian male leadership. It's exclusively to the home and to the local church. It's not a view that anyone believes would bring into the job market or into the political world. It's just simply how we want to run our homes.
Now, you said that you want your students to believe in like truth and reason, and to have an open mind. But aren't you basically teaching your female students that at home they'll answer to their husbands?
We don't really address that all that often. That's not something that is in our curriculum. It may get mentioned in chapel occasionally. Really, it's more of a test of the philosophy of the professors. Is you know, what do you really believe about the Bible? It's a way of testing a professor's fidelity to an orthodox understanding of Scripture. Because the purpose of the Christian worldview statement that you've been talking about is not what we require of students, but what we require of faculty. And so we're asking them, how do you understand the Word of God here? It's akin to saying, do you believe that Adam and Eve were really human beings, were real people? It's another way of testing a person's perspective of God's Word. And so we use those as quick way of understanding a person's fidelity to an Orthodox scriptural translation or scriptural application, rather.
The statement of faith at Patrick Henry College includes Jesus Christ literally will come to earth again in the Second Advent. I've heard that you were a protege of Tim LaHaye, who is famous for the Left Behind series, the incredible best-selling series of novels about the Second Coming. And I know that he believes that the Second Coming is imminent, and he's written books on how to prepare for it. And I wonder if you share that belief that it is imminent, and if so, how that affects your life and your approach to teaching.
Well, you need to define the word imminent first. It can happen at any time. I believe that. Is it likely to happen today? I have no idea. The Bible says, no man knows the day or the hour. And my favorite passage on the Second Coming is called in Luke 17. It's called the Parable of the Persistent Widow. And it's this widow who was unjustly treated by the judge, kept going back to the judge and going back to the judge and demanding justice, demanding justice, demanding justice. And at the end of the parable, the judge finally relents because he's tired of the woman bugging him. And Jesus says at the end of it, when I return, will I find faith on the earth? So what I believe and what I take from that is that I've got to be working for justice. I've got to be working for what's right. I've got to be standing for what's right and demanding that. And I need to be busy about that whenever Jesus comes back. If that's 10 minutes from now or 10 years from now or 10 centuries from now, I haven't got the clue. But I need to be working for those principles he talked about.
Michael Farris is the founder and president of Patrick Henry College, the first college for Christian homeschooled students. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, available in stores and online at bn.com. And from Turner Classic Movies, presenting Race and Hollywood, Black Images on Film, a 38-film retrospective with discussion and commentary, Tuesday and Thursday nights in May. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the Patrick Henry College Honor Code, which includes obtaining parental permission when pursuing a romantic relationship. We continue our conversation with Michael Farris. And John Powers reviews the 1975 film The Passenger, which is now out on DVD. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with Michael Farris, a leader of the Christian homeschool movement. In 2000, he founded Patrick Henry College, the first college for homeschooled Christian students. One of his goals is to prepare these students to bring biblical principles to positions of political leadership. The school has helped students get White House internships and work for congressmen. Farris also founded Generation Joshua, which encourages younger homeschooled Christians to help get out the vote. You know, as we mentioned, there's a statement of faith and a statement of biblical worldview that your college endorses. Students also have to agree to an honor code. So let me just mention a couple of things that are in this. It includes no use of alcohol, tobacco, or illegal drugs, no abusive, lewd, or profane language. The students have to seek and obtain parental permission when pursuing a romantic relationship. And they have to shun obscenity, pornography, and sexually explicit material, reserve sexual activity for the sanctity of marriage, and resolve personal conflicts biblically. Why do you want students to sign on to this honor code before becoming enrolled in your college?
Because we want them to live the way that the Bible teaches.
The part where they have to seek and obtain parental permission when pursuing a romantic relationship.
Right.
I think that's been out of style for a while.
First of all, you need to understand how we that's a matter of honor. They say we will do that. The
mm-hmm.
college doesn't enforce that.
Mm-hmm.
The parents enforce it. If a parent comes to us and says something, that's a different story. But unless we get a parental complaint, the college keeps their hands off that. It's basically a statement of altruism that arises out of the belief that romance isn't really a recreational activity that's serious. The Bible teaches that romance connected to marriage is wonderful. It's great. It's good. But romance that's just for recreation is destructive of a lot of lives. And the pattern that a lot of people go through the college years, what we're really saying is we want the young people to be talking to their parents about the most important decision that they may make while they're in college, and that is, who do I marry? And so it's an altruistic statement, not enforced by the college, saying, please consult your parents.
How does the honor code apply to the larger world? Are these values that you'd like your students to go out and support in their political and social activism in any way?
Well, that's a view that a lot of people ask us about because the political viewpoints that they normally hold embrace a form of coercive utopianism. We don't. We believe a very limited role of government. The government should protect life, liberty, and property and punish those who do evil. It's a very different world. We're not trying to create a utopia for everyone. Absolutely not. It's kind of like Joe Biden once asked me in a Senate hearing, you know, when he heard that I represented homeschoolers, he says, do you want to force everybody to be a homeschooler? And I said, of course not. That's anathema to our way of thinking. And so people who want to force everybody into the public schools, who want to force everybody into a agenda of affirming the current fad of tolerance I believe is a defective form of an embrace of liberty. The historical view of tolerance is not as good as the view of liberty. I think we should be pursuing liberty, not tolerance. We do not want to coerce people into spiritual matters. That is the history of the dissenters. You know, the Baptist dissenters, for example, in Virginia, did not want to coerce people to go to church. There was compulsory attendance in church, and they said that's beyond the pale of government. And people from the evangelical stripe have always held to those kind of principles, that the spirit and the soul do not belong to the dominion of government.
One of the issues you've really been against is gay marriage. You've been for a constitutional amendment that define marriage as a relationship between one man and one woman. The idea of this amendment is coming before Congress again. It passed through the Senate Judiciary Committee. It will soon be voted on by the Senate. And, a lot of people are saying, well, the Christian right always revives this thing about gay marriage when they need to kind of like rally the troops. And, a lot of people have been saying President Bush is kind of interested in seeing this happen again, you know, seeing the whole anti-gay marriage amendment revived again because his ratings, you know, his poll numbers are sinking. And so he needs to rally his base. What's your reaction to that?
Well, first of all, I don't support this particular constitutional amendment. I think it's too weak. I think it allows civil unions. The sponsors of it admit this, and so it's not, I'm not my private analysis, it allows state legislatures to create civil unions. And the only difference between civil union in California, for example, the domestic partnership, or Vermont, the civil union bill, is just the word. And frankly, everybody should be upset with civil unions. It's saying you're going to have all 100% of the rights of marriage. You have to call it something else. And so either gays should have this right or they shouldn't have this right. If they're going to have the right, they shouldn't have to have some second-class name hung around their neck. That's just, you know, that's a compromise that only a politician can love. No real person should ever embrace that kind of nonsense. The Supreme Court of Massachusetts got it right on one thing. When they said that marriage is an institution between two willing adults and an approving state. And so when someone says they want to be legally married, they want the approval of the state. And when they ask for the approval of the state in a democracy, they're asking for the approval of the people. Well, I don't approve. I don't think that we should be putting our sanction and our approval on those relationships. They want to live together, fine. You know, live together all you want. It doesn't bother me. But when you ask for my approval through the state, I don't want to give it because I think it's immoral. And so, you know, this is a battle between the elitists who don't believe in the Republican democratic form of government and want to rule the world through the courts, and those who believe that the nation should be ruled by our elected officials. That's the battle.
Is there a distinction between tolerance and liberty?
Absolutely. Britain, under William and Mary, enacted the Religious Toleration Act in the late 1680s that required everyone to still attend the Church of England unless you adhered to a certain specific narrow range of doctrinal deviances, and then you got a permission from the government to ordain your pastor for these minor variations, and you could get a permission from the government to hold a particular service. You couldn't even call it church. You had to call it a meeting house. And that was tolerance. Tolerance was, we still define what's orthodox, and you're allowed a little bit of deviation. Liberty was, everybody gets to believe whatever they want. And I believe that all this talk of tolerance, when you see politically correct speech codes on college campuses, and you can't go onto a college campus and say with impunity, I think homosexuality is a sin and should be punished by law. If you go and say that on a college campus, you're going to be charged with hate speech. Well, that's tolerance for you. Tolerance cannot coexist with liberty on the long haul, because if people need to be able to say whatever they want to say and not be punished by some hate speech code.
But again, you have no problem legislating against homosexual behavior or a homosexual marriage, and you don't think that's depriving gay people of liberty.
We're talking the difference between behavior and speech. The most fundamental activity of liberty is freedom of believing and the freedom of speaking. Behavior has never been absolute. No one believes that all behavior should be allowed. But, you know, just as I think it's perfectly appropriate to have laws that punish people for racial discrimination, it would be anathema to me to muzzle people who disagree with that concept. I think they should be able to speak whatever they want to speak about that. And so I believe in legislating for racial equality. I believe in legislating for equality of women in the workplace. But I sure would support the right of the people who disagree with those concepts to legislate or to speak out on those matters. And what I'm saying is that the crowd of tolerance wants to ban speech. And so that, you know, this focus back on, behavior is missing the point. The point is who gets to say what. And those who want to create hate speech codes and who want to silence those who criticize homosexuality are enemies of free speech.
There's been some controversy surrounding your school lately. I think it's 5 of the school's 16 full-time professors resigned this year after teaching things that were deemed to be violations of the statement of faith. And
that's not true.
Let me finish saying this, and then you can correct me. One teacher, David Ngo, co-authored an article arguing that the Bible is not the only source of truth and that students can learn valuable lessons from non-Christian writings. So not true?
Well, not as stated. I mean, you're in the zone of it. There's some truth in what you're saying, but you're wrong. First of all, no one at the college ever accused them of violating the statement of faith. No one at the college ever fired these people for anything they wrote or said.
I said they resigned.
They resigned, and we've never taken the position that you can't learn from anything besides the Bible. I mean, for heaven's sakes, I teach constitutional law. We read Supreme Court opinions. We read the founding documents. We read the Federalist Papers. It's not a class consisting of just a few verses from the New Testament and maybe some Psalms from the Old Testament thrown in for good measure. We read Plato, we read Aristotle, we read Nietzsche, we read, Marx. We read all kinds of things. So it's a straw man to suggest that the only, there's two choices, either the Bible and nothing else or other principles. The debate has been about this, whether or not it's necessary to read human wisdom critically or not. Are we going to read Aristotle and Augustine devotionally, or are we going to read them critically? And it's my contention that we're going to read everything that any human being has ever written critically. That the only thing that deserves to be read devotionally is the Bible itself. And because these guys got offended that I said a few things, that some of their favorite guys should be read critically, like Augustine, I said, I think we got to read Augustine critically. They got offended at that, and they decided not to come back.
My guest is Michael Farris, the founder of Patrick Henry College, the first college for Christian students who were homeschooled. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Farris, the founder of Patrick Henry College, the first college for Christian students who were homeschooled. One of his goals is to prepare students to bring biblical values to political leadership positions. Now, you have 10 children, and they've all been homeschooled. Why did you want to homeschool them?
Well, our oldest daughter was in a Christian school in first grade when we first heard of the idea of homeschooling, and the guy that presented the idea to us said that kids get their values from the people that they spend the majority of their time with. If they spend their time with their friends, they get their values from their friends. If they majority of their time with their parents, they get their values from their parents. And we had observed that kind of behavior already going on in our daughter who was six and in first grade. And she thought way too much about what her six-year-old friends thought about the issues of life compared to what her mother and I thought. And so we thought, we're smarter than six-year-olds, and we'd rather our daughter get her values from us. And so we said we'd try homeschooling for a while. Well, that was 24 years ago, and we've been homeschooling quite a while now, and it's been very, very successful.
What kind of schooling did you have?
I went to public school K through 12. I went to a secular liberal arts college, Whitman College, for 2 years, and then transferred to a state university where I graduated in political science and went to a Jesuit law school, Gonzaga University.
Do you feel like the secular schools had a damaging effect on you?
I came home from at Thanksgiving break my freshman year of college and told my dad that I thought that Christian humanism was the right philosophy, and which, as I went back in retrospect, I thought about that. Humanism is a contrary philosophy to Christianity, and I was still trying to hang on to it by modifying humanism, but Christian was the adjective in the sentence, then humanism was the noun. And so what I was really embracing was humanism, and I was trying to hang on to some kind of Christianity. I wasn't really ready to reject it all. So I got turned around by the high school and college education I received. And, you know, I was able to overcome that and to return to the Christian roots that I was raised with. My dad's a public school principal, and so, or at least he's retired now. But, you know, it was interesting to see the effects of all that education that, upon me.
Since your father was a public school principal, I'm really wondering what his reaction has been to your mission of homeschooling, and it's both a personal and a professional mission.
Well, he thought it was a little strange at first, but then he watched our kids, and he really is supportive of homeschooling now. My dad wanted me to be a lawyer for public school districts to defend the school districts against the ACLU, because he thought that the ACLU was pushing the public school system in the wrong philosophical direction. And I wrote my undergraduate honors thesis in school law. The lawyer who did that was the lawyer for the State School Boards Association. So I was being trained and was on a path to be a defender of public schools. But by the time I got through law school, I recognized that the public school establishment as a whole was on the same philosophical side as the ACLU. And so what my dad really wanted for me wasn't going to be possible in that career path. And so I ended up in a different career path, sure enough, in the field of law and education, but defending the principles that, you know, were really behind what he said. He wanted to see people to be able to stand up for what's right and wrong and not be sued for doing so. And I ended up doing that by defending homeschoolers.
Now, you founded the Homeschool Legal Defense Fund. Are you ever concerned that some parents who do homeschooling are in some ways perhaps depriving their children of the kind of expertise that teachers bring in the areas of literature, history, science, math, and that beyond that, some parents are maybe not really good teachers?
Well, you know, if every teacher had true expertise in those areas, that'd be wonderful. It's, you know, it's a fantasy to believe that that's what they're going to be receiving is true expertise. I am an expert in American constitutional law for the purposes of let's evaluate a high school class. You know, vis-a-vis high school teachers, I'm an expert. I can't teach in a public high school. I'm president of a college. I'm not allowed to teach in a public high school because they don't have teacher certification courses. And so the methodology that we use for qualifying people in the public schools does not guarantee expertise in the slightest. I wish it did. I wish we would raise the pay for public school teachers by triple or so on, so that the people clamoring to become public school teachers would really include a whole lot more experts. But the plain facts are homeschool kids do so much better and the academic side of education that there aren't really any legitimate voices anymore raising questions about the academic success of homeschooling. It's proven to be very, very successful. Frankly, one of the reasons is we don't read too many textbooks compared to real books. They're reading more de Tocqueville than they are somebody's summary of American history. And I think that's better for kids to read those real books in the long run.
Do you ever worry that homeschooling deprives children of being with other children, of learning with other children, of socializing with them in school, that it could be a very isolating experience and perhaps a kind of claustrophobic one, particularly for those students who don't necessarily get along famously with their parents?
Well, the first question I ever asked about homeschooling was the one you're essentially posing, and that is I asked this guy, what about socialization, this guy that was an educational psychologist that I mentioned earlier in the program. But it turns out that the socialization skills learned by homeschoolers are actually superior to those that are institutionalized, because socialization really means, first of all, on a technical level, it means teaching people the rules of society from one generation to the next. And the question is, do we want 6-year-olds socializing 6-year-olds and 13-year-olds socializing 13-year-olds? Or do adults teach the next generation the rules of society? And we're reaping a lot of problems in our country because we've allowed far too many kids to be socialized by kids.
What do you think of secular homeschooling?
I think it's, I've defended secular homeschoolers in court countless times. I think that parents, all parents, whether they're secular or Jewish or Christian or Muslim or whatever, they ought to have the full constitutional right to teach their kids at home and teach them their religion or their not religion or whatever they want to teach them.
Well, Michael Farris, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Michael Farris is the founder and president of Patrick Henry College, the first college for Christian homeschooled students. He also founded Generation Joshua and the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. Coming up, John Powers reviews the new DVD release of one of his favorite films. This is Fresh Air. One of the most acclaimed films of the 1970s was Michelangelo Antonioni's The Passenger, starring Jack Nicholson. It's out on a new DVD, and for the first time, home viewers can see it in the original widescreen and with 6 additional minutes not shown in the American theatrical release. It's a personal favorite of critic John Powers, who says that it's not an easy film, but a good one.
When The Passenger came out in 1975, it was one of the most avant-garde movies ever made by a Hollywood studio. It still is. Born of the cinematic ferment of that era, this metaphysical thriller boasted the kind of odd couple pairing you'd never see today. It starred Jack Nicholson at his peak. He was in between Chinatown and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. But it was made by Michelangelo Antonioni, the great Italian art film director whose work had the high seriousness of a T.S. Eliot or James Joyce. Nicholson plays David Locke, a TV journalist who's covering a rebel movement in the North African desert. Locke is sick of his life, and when he finds the guy in the next hotel room dead, a man named Robertson who looks a lot like him, he impulsively decides to swap identities. He leaves behind his own wife and career and begins keeping the appointments in Robertson's calendar. Traveling from London to Germany to Spain, he gets involved with gunrunners and an attractive young woman played by Maria Schneider, best known as Marlon Brando's lover in Last Tango in Paris. But while Locke's story has the stuff of an ordinary thriller, a sexy dame, men with guns, and exotic locations, Locke himself is driven by something bigger and vaguer than defeating the bad guys. Just as Nicholson has thrown himself into a role radically unlike his usual Hollywood star turns, so Locke himself is searching for a new role, a different way of living. In this early scene, Robertson and he meet and begin talking about how they see the world.
Airports, taxi, hotel, they're all the same in the end.
I don't agree. It's us who remain the same. We translate every situation, every experience into the same old codes. We just condition ourselves.
We're creatures of habit. That's what you mean?
Something like that. I mean, however hard you try, it stays so difficult to get away from your own habits. Even the way we talk to these people, the way we treat them, it's mistaken. I mean, how do you get their confidence? Do you know?
Well, it's like this, Mr. Locke. You work with words, images, fragile things. I come with merchandise, concrete things. They understand me straight away.
Yes. Maybe.
The Passenger is a whole movie about not being sure. In its emphasis on the great riddles of existence, it seems very much of its era. There's something of a time capsule quality about Locke's fascination with the Third World. Who today would look to African rebels for inspiration? And about Antonioni's obsession with the big intellectual themes of post-war Europe. Capital A, alienation. Capital I, identity. Capital E, existence. Indeed, Locke's journey is so unabashedly symbolic that it will strike some viewers as capital S slow and capital P pretentious. especially as Antonioni tells his story visually, conveying meaning not with talk, but with imagery, from the sprawling vastness of the Algerian desert to the surreal glitter of Gaudi's Barcelona. The Passenger is slow, I grant you, but just because something might seem pretentious doesn't mean that it actually is. This movie explores a common modern feeling, the desire to escape from one's established self and find a deeper relationship to what we might call eternity. Tired of being a professional observer, Locke wants to be involved in the world, to see, as he puts it, what's on the other side of the window. He thinks that there he might find freedom, authenticity, and meaning. But of course, things aren't so simple. In a movie about learning to see things in a new way, we eventually do discover what's on the other side of the window, and it comes in the film's famous climax, one of the greatest shots in movie history. Almost 7 minutes long, this shot resolves the mystery of the plot. But in its enigmatic peacefulness, it remains as teasing as a Zen koan, as mystical as a vision of the universe that far exceeds human consciousness. The Passenger is not a perfect film, and you shouldn't watch it if you're tired. But in an age when our movies pose simple questions, is it hard being a mutant superhero? I have more patience than ever for a film that asks us to think about how we know who we are, or whether, in the grand scheme of things, all of us are finally just passengers.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menjivar. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of Sunstorm, a crime novel about a lawyer who is unexpectedly summoned back to her hometown in northern Sweden by Asa Larsson. From Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. Information at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that more students graduate from high school ready for college, work, and citizenship. GatesFoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Willie Nelson talks about his songs, his early demos, and his new book, The Tao of Willie. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Crazy, crazy for feeling so lonely.